From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we look back at the year in tech, including Boston getting a thanks but no thanks from Amazon.
I don't look at this as a negative. I look at this as an opportunity we went through. Boston doesn't need HU2 to be successful. We already are.
Also today, how food ended up at the center of the culture wars and what's unique about Boston's restaurant scene.
Boston has been such a national leader in the number of top restaurants that are run by women. So there wasn't that same male-dominated restaurant culture here. And, you know, I think it's one thing Boston should be really proud of. That's just
the
way
you make me feel. The Year in Music with Renee Graham. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Well, we've got less than a week left in 2018, and we thought we'd spend some time looking back at some of the biggest stories of the year. Later in the show, we're going to reflect on the year in music and in food, but we're going to start today with a look back at the year in technology. And to help us with that is WBUR Bostonomics reporter Callum Borchers. Callum, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana.
Hi there. Hey, listeners, we want to hear from you. What are you thinking about when you think about tech this year? Are you rethinking its value, how it helps us and how it harms us? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. All right, Callum, let's get this out of the way because one of the big tech stories of 2018 was a bit of a letdown for Boston. Yeah. Centers around a company that a few of us, like maybe me, did a lot of their Christmas shopping with this year.
Yeah, I maybe did my share of Amazon Prime shopping this season as well. And of course, Boston was one of the HQ2 finalists. This was the much-hyped search for a place that was going to house some 50,000 jobs. And of course, in the end, Tiziana, nobody got 50,000 jobs. Amazon chose to split its headquarters 25 and 25 between New York and Virginia.
So they didn't come here, and there are some mixed feelings about bringing a company like Amazon because you get jobs, but you have to give up a lot, too. So what did New York and Virginia give them in terms of perks? And at the end of the day, did they just offer a better deal than we did?
That may have been a big part of it. I mean, between those two locations, New York and Virginia, Amazon got $2.8 billion, with a B, in combined tax incentives. And without getting specific, we heard Boston's Mayor Marty Walsh say that Amazon wouldn't have gotten anything close to that in Massachusetts. And in fact, on this program, we had Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone say that his city didn't offer any tax breaks. So that clearly was a factor. On the other hand, if they had simply chased the most money, they would have gone to Maryland or New Jersey, which offered even more money.
And they didn't go there either.
That's right.
So now the hope, if Amazon picked us or one of these big investments where a new headquarters comes, is that it's going to spur some investment in infrastructure, sort of new development, housing, transportation. Did this make us miss out on a chance to build up the city?
It possibly did. Boston's development chief, John Barros, said during the selection process that one of his frustrations is that the city of Boston hasn't been able to convince the state legislature to invest more in the T, but he thought that perhaps Boston would have better luck with a massive Amazon jobs package. In other words, something they could go to state lawmakers and say, look, we've got 50,000 workers coming. We need you to invest. But, you know, Boston officials have done their best to put a nice shine on missing out on HQ2. In fact, at a news conference in November, after the selection was finalized, this is what the Boston Mayor Marty Walsh said.
I don't look at this as a negative. I look at this as an opportunity we went through. Boston doesn't need HU2 to be successful. We already are.
And, you know, Tiziana, I heard similar sentiments from mayors in other cities as well. Keep in mind that at the beginning of this process, there were some two dozen cities in Massachusetts, many of which that just sort of put in long shot bids for Amazon HQ2, knowing they probably wouldn't get it. And after the fact, when I talked to them, they said, you know, it was still a valuable exercise, even though we didn't end up getting it in the end.
And are there lessons to be learned here for us?
Well, I think one of the big ones is don't wait for some external catalyst to prompt the infrastructure investment that you're looking for. Remember that the last thing that was supposed to compel more spending on public transit was the Olympics, a bid that we eventually abandoned. And so if Massachusetts wants a better MBTA, maybe it should just make the investment and not wait for some other thing to arrive here and force our hand.
All right. Now, before we go on, our callers are calling. So we've got Jacob on the line from Lowell. Jacob, how are you? All right. I think we may have lost Jacob. Well, there he is. Hi, Jacob.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, welcome to Radio Boston. Yes, Jacob, I can. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi. I think the big story of the year was CRISPR, actually, where there's a lot of controversy surrounding the story that came out of China. I think it really forces us to have a conversation about where biotech is going. And I think there's a lot of potential to alleviate, you know, diseases and human suffering through this technology.
Great, Jacob,
so
thanks.
I'm optimistic about it.
So Jacob's on the phone expressing optimism, Callum, around CRISPR, which is the gene editing technology. And, of course, there was the big event this year in China where twins were born who had had their genes edited. What does that mean for us, and what do you think about how we're going to think about CRISPR in 2019?
Yeah, it certainly forced a hard conversation that was probably coming anyway. But here was a scientist who sort of went rogue, went around the typical conventions of a scientific experiment and was pretty universally condemned. But I do think what you see, and here in Boston, too, which is a CRISPR hub, by the way. We have folks like George Church and Feng Zhang, who are among the leaders in this field. And those two gentlemen, by the way, are kind of split on this. You know, you had George Church, for example, saying that, you know, an attempt to eradicate a disease like HIV, which is what this Chinese scientist was trying to do, could be a worthy cause for experimenting on people, although that this particular one wasn't conducted right. You know, and Zhang took the opposite approach and said, you know what, we need a moratorium on this kind of experimentation. So that's a really hard conversation that's coming.
Yeah. You know, we have so many challenges with new technologies, how we respond to them, regulate them. So let's turn from China back to Massachusetts, because we've got a story that's still unfolding. In the Massachusetts House and Senate, leaders reached a compromise last week on some potential regulations for short-term rentals. Those are the things like what you have on Airbnb. What would that compromise actually do, and what's the latest on the regulations? I know this has been a long time coming.
It has. So I'd say there's two highlights in the compromise bill that was just passed. One would apply the state's 5.7% hotel tax to these short-term rentals like Airbnbs. Cities still have the option to add additional taxes on that if they want, or they could even ban short-term rentals. And then there's also going to be a state registry of short-term rental properties. So I'd say those are the two biggies. Where does it stand? Well, it's sitting on Governor Baker's desk right now, and his deadline to decide whether to sign it or not is this coming Sunday. And if he does sign, the regulations would take effect on July 1st, just in time for the summer rental season.
All right. Now, a lot of that sounds familiar. So this was not the first attempt to regulate short-term rentals. Is that correct?
That's right. We did see the legislature pass a similar bill over the summer, but the governor did decline to sign that one. And the reason was he had two big concerns. So this version that just passed in the last week has addressed those objections. So number one was the governor wanted people who rent their homes to maintain some measure of privacy. So within that registry that I was talking about, it would list only the street names but not the full addresses. So you could, for example, find out like how many properties in your general neighborhood are being used for short-term rentals, but you wouldn't necessarily know that you know, John and Sally down the street are the specific ones doing it. And the governor also didn't want people who rely who rent out their homes only occasionally to have to pay that 5.7% hotel tax. So if you're someone who, you know, just occasionally goes out of town for the weekend and you put up your house, if you do it for less than 14 days out of the year, you're exempt from having to pay the hotel tax.
Okay. Now, we've had cities trying to regulate and the state trying to regulate. In this case, you are talking about statewide regulations.
That's right.
And how is that different? Because Boston passed some regulations that have been controversial, you know, depending on what side of this business you sit on. So how are these things different or the same?
That's right. So Boston took its own action this year, and some of those regulations are going to go into effect on New Year's Day. So they're coming right down the pike. Some are in pause right now because Airbnb has sued the city. But the big one that the city says it is going to enforce is a ban on short-term rentals of investment properties. So the Boston City Council is basically saying, we're fine with people renting out rooms or homes that they actually live in. So that example I gave earlier, you go out of town for the weekend and you put your home up. Totally fine with that. What the city council wants to crack down on is people who own multiple properties, or maybe it's companies, and they just snap up these investment properties that they don't actually live in. And instead of actually renting them out to people who need full-time housing, they rent them out by the night on a short-term basis like Airbnb. That's what they're trying to crack down on, because there's a sort of a housing shortage in the city. And their city council is worried about those properties not being available to people who need full-time places to live.
So they're trying to manage the rental market.
That's right.
For the everyday person. So this is big business. Short-term rentals have been around a long time. Why is it so hard to get regulations passed here?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that the governments have been slow to act, both the state level and the municipal level. You know, an entire short-term rental economy has been built around one set of rules, or perhaps lack of rules, and now governments are trying to make those changes years later. Airbnb has been operating in Massachusetts for a long time, and so naturally there's a lot of pushback, both from the companies and from the homeowners who are used to having sort of a side hustle here.
Okay. I'm going to shift gears, no pun intended, to a word that I love, which is scooter, because I think this has been a big story in 2018. I know you've been following it. It's going to be even bigger in 2019. You did a lot of reporting on these electric scooters being deployed in Cambridge and Somerville this last year. Remind us how that all started.
Well, it came by surprise to the city officials, most notably. So all of a sudden in July, a California startup called Bird Rides deployed dozens of these dockless rentable electric scooters without notice in Cambridge and Somerville, which really irritated the mayors in both of those cities. The cities ultimately issued cease and desist orders and actually began to confiscate the scooters to get them off the street when Bird didn't initially comply with those orders. Eventually, Bird did take the scooters off the street after about a month.
Okay, so bumpy start. Now it's 5 months later. Where do we stand on them now in Greater Boston? What can we expect in 2019?
Well, I would say tensions have eased a little bit. And, you know, officials in Cambridge, Somerville, and even Boston, which it also said stay out of here, say that they're open to piloting a program with rentable electric scooters this coming spring. But the big holdup, Tiziana, is a state law that requires electric scooters to have blinkers and brake lights. And the scooters right now don't have either one of those.
So I don't even know where you'd fit them on the
machine. That's exactly one of the complaints from the companies is where would we put them? And so without that modification or a change in state law, they're not willing to give out the permits. And so what you have is officials in these cities saying, hey, state legislature, you need to change the law. We'll see if that happens in the next term.
So if it does, is Boston going to see scooters on its streets?
Well, City Councilor Matt O'Malley certainly thinks so. And in fact, one of his former aides is actually Bird's legislative affairs director. And he told me that if Boston is actually the innovation hub that it claims to be, then the city should get on board with these scooters.
I firmly believe that we should be embracing this. Boston is a hub of technology, and particularly as it relates to transportation. We were the first subway system in the United States, so I think it's only fitting that we're having this conversation to discuss micromobility, particularly electric scooters, in ways that we can make it work for all neighborhoods and all citizens of Boston.
And all neighborhoods is really the key phrase there. You know, part of O'Malley's pro-scooter argument is that they could help solve a transportation problem in the neighborhoods of Boston that have poor MBTA service right now.
All right. Now, last story here, and it is a biggie. This was the year that many of us kind of fell in love. I mean, out of love.
Yeah. Yeah.
With the tech giants, especially in social media. We saw how they trade our personal information, and it seems like no matter how many times they tell us they're committed to improving, we keep ending up dealing with these same issues. So, for example, how many times have folks at Facebook promised to protect our privacy, limit the spread of misinformation? Remind us about them in particular. What are some of the big stories that came out about them and the social media giant world in general this year?
Yeah, well, maybe the biggest one was in the spring when Facebook had to acknowledge that the outside data firm Cambridge Analytica had been able to improperly gather detailed personal info about some 87 million users, most of whom were Americans. That's what led to Mark Zuckerberg's first ever appearance on Capitol Hill. Remember, he had been refusing to go up until this year. Yeah. And then in September, Facebook said hackers had stolen the login codes to another 50 million accounts. So we're now up into over 100 million people affected here. And then just this month, the New York Times reported extensively on Facebook's data sharing practices. And I'd say the big takeaway from that is that Mark Zuckerberg left out a lot of key information in that congressional testimony, Tiziana, when he said that Facebook doesn't sell user data. That might technically be true, but what the Times found was that Facebook essentially barters that information with other technology companies, sharing the user data as a way of generating ad revenue. And this is the old saying, right, that if the product is free, then you are the product. That's what they're saying, right? Facebook is free to use, but the thing that makes you valuable to Facebook is that they can tell other companies about you, and they can target ads to the things that you like.
You know, I'm glad that you mentioned other tech companies because it's been a bumpy year, not just for Facebook, but also Google, Apple, Amazon, Netflix. They've experienced dips in their stock. What is going on? Is this just a blip on the radar? Is there a serious sign of trouble for the tech sector going on here?
You know, there's sort of broad trends, and then there are specific problems in each case. So, for example, the whole stock market is really volatile right now. I mean, you use a company like Facebook. We just talked about some of the problems they have. You know, they're 52-week high. this year was about $219 a share. They're now trading right at about $130 a share. So how much of that is specific to the bad PR year that they have had, mm-hmm. and how much is the market overall? A little bit hard to say. But you could look at another company like Tesla, which has been one of the you know, hot tech darlings for a few years. A lot of people put a lot of faith in Elon Musk that he is going to be the innovative leader to lead that company to profitability. Hasn't happened yet. And of course, his sort of erratic behavior on social media has, I think, shaken people's confidence in him as a leader. And then you look at a company like Apple, for example, which has been profitable for a long time. But I think that some consumers are sort of wondering, you know, what are they willing to pay for devices that are incrementally more fantastic than the last one? You know, I still use an iPhone 7, Tiziana, and it works just fine for me. Are you willing to shell out $1,000 for the latest, you know, iPhone 10?
Right.
And I think, you know, what we've seen so far is that sales on the latest iPhone devices haven't lived up to the company's hopes.
Yeah. All right. Now, Callum, very quickly, privacy, hacking, expenses, fake news, lots going on in social media. I'm very mindful that this has been a year of women. What's the story about women in tech companies, their leadership, their controversies? Just a couple thoughts from you to wrap up.
Well, I think the story of it here in Massachusetts anyway was that you know, when the Massachusetts Technology Leadership Council announced the individual executive award nominees this year, they were once again, for the third year in a row, all men. So you had this streak of, I think it was 30 straight nominations of all men, with women being completely excluded.
Jeez.
And people kind of scratch their heads and say, what's going on here? And I think the answer, in short, was that there wasn't enough overture, enough solicitation saying we want women to submit their nominations for these awards, because the way it was structured, it rewarded men who raised their hands and said, I'm awesome, I'm doing a great job, and sort of nominating themselves.
Yeah.
I think that's something that you might see more attention on in the coming year.
All right. That's Callum Borchers, WBUR Bostonomics reporter on the major tech stories of 2018. Callum Borchers, thanks so much for being here on Radio Boston.
Great to be here.
All right. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 2018 has been a major year for food, and do I love food? There have been all kinds of exciting trends when it comes to what's on the plate, but there's also been some really deep cultural changes and losses to restaurants and to kitchens around the country. Joining me now to talk about some of the year's highest highs and lowest lows in food is Amy Traverso, senior food editor for Yankee Magazine. Amy, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be back.
I'm glad. Hey, it's been a big year for me, too, and time's up in restaurants. Listeners, have you worked in a restaurant? How has the culture changed or not changed in the kitchen? Or are you thinking about food? How have you changed the way you eat this year? What new recipes are you following? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Amy, I want to talk about the food, but first I want to talk about the culture around it. Let's start there because it's been a big year. Mm-hmm. Just yesterday, L'Espalier, the modern French restaurant in the Back Bay, announced its closing without fanfare after 40 years. They'll close on December 31st. What does the city lose with the closing of this restaurant, and what, whether it's a restaurant or a cuisine, do you think is going to fill that void?
Well, I think, you know, Frank McClellan, the owner and chef at L'Espalier, has been such a bar setter for quality in Boston. And, you know, he was really instrumental in bringing the kind of farm-to-table aesthetic to truly fine dining,
mm-hmm.
to a place where it's silver and white tablecloths and there's somebody coming out with a cheese cart and it's fancy, fancy. You know, he said his lease is up and he just wasn't interested in renewing it. He has a farm up in Essex, Massachusetts that he's running. He says he has an unnamed project in the works. I think really what it means is, you know, the way people want to eat now is so different. We want shared plates. We want to be more casual. Dining out doesn't have to, fine dining doesn't have to be fancy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for him to pivot, to roll with that change with a restaurant like L'Espalier, it would have been like turning around a luxury yacht in a very tight space. Like, I'm not sure L'Espalier could have been reimagined to cater to that contemporary way of dining. So I guess what we lose is a little bit of that elevated elegance. You know, Lockober's gone and it's been replaced with Avance, which is really cool and sexy and elegant, but but more casual than Lockover was. And I think L'Espalier was kind of one of the last of its kinds. I think we're going to be left with a lot of steakhouses when you want to get to that really expensive, fancy, formal service kind of restaurant.
So we're keeping the good food, but we're losing some of the fancy.
Yeah. And a little bit of the sitting for 4 hours for dinner. That's not all that L'Espalier did. I mean that people are a little less patient with those kind of multi-course dinners.
All right. Now, it was a year of loss in some other areas, too. We lost a number of really influential chefs and food writers. Most notably, of course, is Anthony Bourdain, the writer, the travel documentarian, and celebrity chef. He committed suicide tragically, which really reverberated not just, you know, in these intense foodie circles, but for so many people around the world. We lost some other big figures this year, too. Joël Robuchon, who was a French celebrity chef, he died at age 73. Paul Bocuse, also a French chef, died at 91. And the LA Times and Pulitzer Prize-winning restaurant critic Jonathan Gold died young.
Yeah.
At 57. What kind of effect do those losses have on the food and restaurant community?
Well, I think, certainly the reverberations with Anthony Bourdain's death, I think, continue. I think people just felt so personally connected to him. He was also famously just a very generous person with his time, his encouragement. So there are a lot of people who felt that he'd not just touched their lives through his writing, but it actually, you know, helped make an introduction or just encourage them in their work in the food world. So I think people really feel his loss. And, of course, it was so shocking. Jonathan Gold, I mean, what a singular voice. I actually was rereading some of his work, and it brought tears to my eyes how beautifully he wrote about everything from, you know, fine dining in L.A. to taco trucks and why it's so the joy of eating at a taco truck at, you know, 11 o'clock at night in the winter in L.A. So those are just voices that are irreplaceable. Other voices will come, obviously, along. But, you know, Jonathan Gold, he was the first food writer to win a Pulitzer Prize for criticism. That was a huge benchmark. And I think it set a bar for the rest of us. And, you know, as far as great chefs, they changed cuisine as we knew it. They brought a modern spirit to French cooking, and you know, their influence, their dishes, in particular, Joël Robuchon. He did a dish with a version of potatoes, pomme soufflé, potatoes that were cooked equal part. It was basically equal parts butter and potato. That dish, I see it in other restaurants as a tribute to him. So I think his dishes will live on for sure.
I actually really like the juxtaposition of the 4-hour meal with the 11 p.m. taco truck.
Yes.
It just sort of gives us the full expanse of food and how we love to engage with it and consume it.
Yeah.
You know, I have really felt like 2018 was another really important year for women, strong women, vocal women. You know, hashtag Me Too and Time's Up both really took hold in the restaurant world this year. Among many incidents in September, the Times-Picayune reported that 25 women, 25, were sexually harassed while working for the Besh Restaurant Group down in New Orleans, co-owned by celebrity chef John Besh. Are we seeing those kinds of claims and that culture play out in the greater Boston restaurant scene as well?
Not nearly as much, which is not to say that those things haven't happened in Boston. But I really think this is a moment when we can give our city some credit, because in a way that no other city has managed to replicate, Boston has long been led by women chefs, and women chefs who own multiple restaurants. Think of Barbara Lynch and Jody Adams, Lydia Shire and Anna Sorton, Joanne Chang. Having these women in such senior roles has, I think, changed the entire culture of Boston, food culture and the restaurant culture, because their protégés have gone on to open their own restaurants. And so they're cross-pollinating the city and making Boston a place where many women run kitchens. And that completely, I mean, if you want to change the kitchen culture, if you want to change that macho frat guy culture that ran kitchens for decades, that's a really good way to do it, is to put a woman in charge. So I think a lot of it was maybe Julia Child setting a certain expectation that women could be leaders in food. And the women who came up after her have changed the culture. And that's maybe one reason why we haven't seen as many explosive revelations out of Boston. I'd also say, you know, I used to work at Boston Magazine. I was food editor there. And there was a time where there were these kind of packs of chef dudes roaming the city, and their antics were kind of legendary. Now I'd say that culture seems to have really gone away. That is not something that anybody's bragging bragging about anymore. It's not. It's just not as big a leader in the restaurant culture.
Okay, so it's encouraging to hear about these strong women leaders. It's encouraging to hear that maybe we're ahead of the curve. We're still not immune to the cultural problems. Earlier this year, Tiffany Faison, who is a co-owner of Sweet Cheeks Q and Tiger Mama, she told Meghna Chakrabarty that it was what it was like coming up as a female chef in the Boston food scene. Let's listen to that.
You know, I remember when I first started working at Daniel Ballou's restaurant in the Wynn, and I was at that point, I was the chef de partie on fish, which is a difficult station. You lead the fish station. And I had some kid come over from Garmage, and he was like, hey, you want to trade? And I thought, like, he was a line cook, and I was already, like, two positions above him. And just that, like, blind ignorance of, like, hey, you want to trade? Like, no, I've worked my butt off for this.
Now, despite those challenges coming up in the Boston food world, she was a finalist for the 2018 James Beard Award for Best Chef of the Northeast. And speaking of culture change, interestingly, earlier this year, the James Beard Award Foundation, which awards that prize, announced that in the wake of the Time's Up movement, the committee is going to consider restaurant culture and leadership values when making their determinations for Best Chef. Do you see this awareness and these kinds of changes improving kitchen culture? Are you optimistic?
I'm optimistic. I think, you know, a lot of traditional kitchens were based on the French model, which was incredibly militaristic and strictly hierarchical. It was very hard for women to find, as Tiffany said, and she's another example of a woman who's with multiple restaurants who's changed the culture. It was very hard for women to enter that culture. As that becomes dismantled, you're now, you know, the classic image of the macho chef throwing pans at the underlings, swearing, carrying on, being ridiculous, unprofessional, that just doesn't fly anymore. You know, restaurants used to be a place where people who maybe couldn't fit into corporate America could find a place to be themselves and be creative. But what went along with that was a lot of bad behavior. I think what we're figuring out now is you don't have to act like a jerk to be creative and still be a little bit outside the cookie cutter, you know, corporate culture.
I hope that we're learning in lots of places that you don't have to act like a jerk to be creative. All right, I want to shift gears just a little bit from food culture to food policy, and I want to talk about SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It's the U.S. Food Assistance Program, and it's kind of a perennial lightning rod in the wars about welfare and welfare benefits. Earlier this month, President Trump announced that his administration was going to try to tighten work requirements for adults who rely on SNAP, which is also food stamps. And that's probably going to mean that more people are going to lose their benefits. Last week, the president explained the decision at a press conference. Let's listen to that for a sec.
Millions of able-bodied working-age adults continue to collect food stamps without working or even looking for work. Our goal is to move these Americans from dependence to independence and into a good-paying job and rewarding career.
Okay, so now we've got food at the center of this battle about the role of government and of welfare. And I think it's especially poignant because the Obama administration put such an emphasis on food, nutrition, and healthful choices with things like the First Lady's Let's Move campaign and her push for Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act. The Trump administration has been criticized for trying to water down some of these policies. And I wonder, what do you make of food finding itself at the heart of these particular political and culture wars?
Well, it's interesting. I still find it interesting when I'm talking to people about food, and they'll kind of ask me, well, why is food writing interesting or why is food writing important? And I say, well, what was the first thing you did this morning? Chances are you ate food. And there are a lot of things that go into the eggs that ended up in your frying pan or the coffee that was in your mug. There's policy, there's culture. I mean, that's why I love writing and thinking about food, because for me, it's sort of a liberal arts education that never ends. You know, the Farm Bill is a massive undertaking. It comes up every 5 years. It's a package that regulates, you know, $867 billion of spending. And a lot of what happens in the hashing out of the Farm Bill is a battle between representatives from rural areas and representatives from urban areas. The rural areas want a lot of aid for farmers who are being affected by the trade war, by climate change, by a lot of other things, by, you know, instability in the commodities market. Urban senators and congresspeople want funding for things like SNAP and farmers markets, and they're duking it out in there. Fortunately, you know, the compromise bill that did pass did not include the restrictions that the House wanted to pass on SNAP and food aid. Mm-hmm. However, I know the Trump administration wants to work around it and try to sort of backdoor that the cutbacks on those programs. So we'll see what happens. You know, fingers crossed. There are some good news, though. I mean, there's quadrupling in funding on organic research on organic farming. It'll be very interesting to see what happens as hemp has become legalized on an industrial scale.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at a $20 billion hemp industry coming down the pike and a lot of CBD oil coming out of that. So that'll be interesting.
So, Amy, we've got just a little bit of time left, and I feel like we should actually talk about food, too. So tell us what kind of food trends you saw this past year, particularly here in the New England region.
So there's been a lot, and it's been fun to watch. One thing I'm seeing is this kind of next level idea of health food. I mean, I remember in the 80s, everybody was eating oat bran to bring down their cholesterol. So health food is nothing new, clearly. But there's a different tone to it. I was trying to put my finger. Why is it different? I was seeing a lot of emphasis on nutraceuticals and ingredients that were anti-inflammatory. And inflammation is like the bugaboo, right? Matcha, cacao, turmeric. And I realized that I think what's happening here, why we've become so fixated on adding these nutraceuticals to our food, is because I think there's a sense of chaos in our external environment, climate change. There's a lot of anxiety about our health and our future. And these foods represent a way for us to take control of our internal environment. That's one area where we have control. Mm-hmm. I think that might be behind this because there's a heating up of that. But let's talk about fun stuff. Tahini is like been in everywhere. Everybody's putting tahini in their brownies, in their donuts, in
savory
sauces.
And what is in tahini?
Tahini's basically, it's like peanut butter but made with sesame seeds. And so you see it traditionally in a lot of Middle Eastern cuisines, in halva, which is like candy. It's almost like a fudge made with tahini. You'll see it everywhere. Look for that. Look for Portuguese food to be kind of a hot cuisine in the next year. Boston and Massachusetts have a large Portuguese population. In Providence, Rhode Island, there's a new Portugale market that is sort of like a small version of Italy for Portuguese food.
Yeah.
There's also been a lot of interest in travel to Portugal. It's relatively affordable. I'm seeing a lot of Instagram trips to Portland. So when you see that kind of tourism interest, chances are people are going to come back and they're going to be wanting to eat that food.
Do you have a favorite Portuguese dish?
That's such a good question. I mean, Portuguese food is so great when it comes to sort of beautiful wood-grilled fish with great olive oil. I love that. Love dried salt cod and all the different yummy things you can make with that. Love the uses of sort of those warm, smoky spices. Love Portuguese wine, too. So there's a lot there to explore. Sprinkles. Everybody's obsessed with sweet and savory sprinkles right now.
Sprinkles like the
like
things
sprinkles,
you sprinkle
like
on top
colorful
of stuff.
Sprinkles are, and I think that's driven a lot by Instagram, but also savory ones. Middle Eastern spice blends like Duca and za'atar and everything bagel sprinkles on everything. Yeah. So
right.
that's one of the lighter trends that's sort of fun to watch.
Excellent. Yeah. All right. And on that note, one last trend that you expect in 2019 that we should be looking for.
Alternative flours, not just for people with gluten sensitivities. Rye flour, buckwheat flour, they are delicious and so much more interesting than white flour. So look for them in baked goods, in breads, even in pasta.
Wow. Okay, alternative flours. That's Amy Traverso, senior food editor at Yankee Magazine. Amy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is our year in music.
Now, I like dollars, I like diamonds, I like stunning, I like shining, I like million-dollar deals. Where's my pen? Bitch, I'm signing.
Baby, don't make me spell it out for you. All of the feelings that I got for you can't be explained, but I can try for you.
So those are just some of the biggest songs of 2018. We heard I Like It by Cardi B, Thank You Next by Ariana Grande, and Boston Globe Associate Editor and columnist Renee Graham's fave of the year, Make Me Feel by Janelle Monáe. And Renee Graham is here in the studio today to break down what she loves about that and some of her other favorites. Hello, Renee, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. Well, thanks. Thanks for coming to Radio Boston. Hey, listeners, we also want to hear from you. What's your favorite album of 2018, your favorite musical moment of the year? Don't hesitate. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet at us at Radio Boston. Renee, let's start with your favorite album of the year, which we heard at the top there. It's Janelle Monáe's Dirty Computer. This is the third album of a decade-long, a 10-year-long career, and it came out back in the spring. What did you love about her album?
I loved everything about this album. It had been a bit of a gap between albums for her, and she admitted part of the problem was she had lost her mentor, Prince. And even before they kind of hooked up and became friends, you kind of heard his influence in her music. And so she really had to rethink it. But it also, I think, liberated her and freed her. And I think what I really loved about Dirty Computer was it's audacious in its sexual expression.
Mm-hmm.
It's about freedom. It's about independence. It's about embracing your difference and your otherness.
So actually, let's hear a little bit more from this song, Make Me Feel, which is off her Dirty Computer album.
You know I love it, so please don't stop it. It's like I'm powerful with a little bit of tender and emotional sexual bender. Mess me up, yeah, but no one does it better. There's nothing better. That's just the way you make me feel.
I kind of feel like we should just play the whole song.
It's just a wonderful song. I mean, it's about the joy of sex.
Yeah.
Period.
There you go.
Can't beat it.
You know, NPR described the album as a, quote, funk pop soundscape. And they described the album as creating a world where, and I'm going to quote this because it's pretty amazing, nonconformity can spell extinction if you don't fight back. And with every guitar riff, every interlude, every moment of loving queer affection, Monáe fights. That's the end of the quote. Tell us a little more about her.
You know, she is an artist who, you know, sort of coming up in the moment, has always created her own sort of time and her way. She's not following really any of the trends that were out there. You know, she sort of played with gender. She played with ideas of sexuality from the beginning of her career, which could have been a death knell for her in a lot of ways because, you know, people weren't necessarily ready to go on that journey with her.
Mm-hmm.
When I think of Janelle Monáe, I think of the comment that Lena Waithe, the actress and writer, made when she won the Emmy a few years ago, where she said, "The things that make us different, those are our superpowers." And in some ways, that's what this album is about. This is about Janelle Monáe completely embracing her superpowers and encouraging the rest of us to do the same.
You know, this was a year in a lot of ways, and I've said this a couple times on the show today already, about superwomen. You had Janelle Monáe. It was a big year for Ariana Grande, for country singer Kacey Musgraves. I want to pivot now to another one of your picks because it is about women, and it focused on women in classical music. The album was called For Women, Music for Solo Piano, and it's by Samantha Agay. Tell me a little bit about this choice from you. Who exactly is she, and what is this music?
She's a British pianist, and she's a classical musician, and what she found is when she was studying, you know, she studied the masters, of course, but she wasn't hearing about any women. And then as she got more and more into the music, she started to hear about women like Florence Price, like Margaret Bonds. And she wondered, like, why don't I know who these women composers are? And, you know, that's what she's doing. She takes music by four women composers who are very little known: Florence Price, Vitislav Kaprilova, Ethel Bilslin, and Margaret Bonds. And what she does is she brings their music to people. You know, the remarkable thing is people always think of classical music as essentially being, you know, white guys.
Right.
And there were lots of women always. You can go back to the 19th century with Fanny Mendelssohn and Clara Schumann. They were making music, but people weren't putting it out there, and it wasn't being performed because they were women. And that's always happened. So what Samantha Agay is trying to do is change that.
So that's so striking. Let's listen to one of those songs. This is the third movement of Florence Price's Sonata in E Minor. It's performed by Samantha Agay herself.
Yes. Thank you.
All right, that album is Four Women Music for Solo Piano, and it's just absolutely beautiful. We're going to go on to some other subjects, but before we do, I want to take a caller, and I'm going to listen here to Pat from Watertown. Pat, welcome to Radio Boston. Pat, do we have you on the line?
Yes, can you hear me?
I can, Pat. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So tell us, Pat, you want to talk about jazz?
Well, I just wanted to mention one of these sort of stories of the year for me is the closing of Ryle's Jazz Club in Cambridge, which was the last of the local independent venues for jazz. And it's not just jazz, it's punk, it's a lot of the other sort of subgenres that have lost their homes in Boston. And it's not clear to me, you know, what's going to happen with those sort of smaller genres for live music.
Pat, thanks so much for that call. And Renee, you know, we heard that word small, we heard the word independent. It does feel like we're losing some of our ability to have good access to edgy, independent, smaller produced music. What's your reaction to Pat's call and to that kind of trend?
You know, the lifeblood of music is live performance. And when you run out of venues where people can go to see performers, that's how you get bonded to performers. You see them live, you see what they do. When you're losing those venues, you start to wonder what's going to happen. And, you know, not to mention, that's how a lot of musicians make their money, touring. You know, they're not making it from records anymore. And so touring is very important, and you have to have those venues. So when you lose places like Ryle's, which was, you know, legendary in the Boston area, you know, it's really a hardship.
Let's take one more call, because we've got another caller here. This is Alex from Melrose. Alex, you're on the air with Radio Boston.
Hi, how are you guys?
Well, Alex, how are you?
Good, good. So I wanted to talk about Astroworld and kind of the rap music scene this year with Travis Scott and Kanye West and Drake and those other rappers. I kind of felt like Astroworld kind of shaped the college music scene this year and kind of, you know, changed the way college students listen to music. And I wanted to know how you guys felt about, like, the rap scene becoming more prevalent in modern music and more popular music today.
Great. Alex, thanks for calling in. And let me just direct that question a little more specifically, Renee, because we had a real loss in that community this year, which was the death of Mac Miller. He was a rapper from Pittsburgh, and he was this early internet success story, and he released his fifth album in the spring. And then in September, he died at his home in California from an overdose at just 26. He was one of the leading lights in rap music. And how are you thinking about his death? What does that mean to us? And where are these cultural influences that are changing how, as Alex said, people are listening to music today?
You know, the loss of Mac Miller is, I think people are still measuring how deep this is going to go. He was not just extremely talented, but it was the way he was changing. You were watching him evolve from this sort of frat boy rap he was doing early on to where he got very, you know, experimental and much more introspective. And that's why his album this year, his last album, Swimming, I thought was so important and so good, because he was really talking about things that were going on in his life and not with a lot of distance. He'd had this 2-year relationship with Ariana Grande, which broke up, you know, primarily because of his issues with substance abuse.
Yeah.
And he talked very openly about that. He wasn't critical of her at all, but it was just someone who was trying to figure out a way to get healthy and live a better life. And the fact that he didn't succeed, the fact that he's not still with us, sort of speaks to how much he understood what was going on in his life.
You know, his album Swimming came out in the spring, and as we mourn his loss with that struggle with addiction, let's take a minute to hear from this single, Self-Care. Renee, you talked about how open Mac Miller was about his struggles with addiction and his life. You can hear it in his music. He was really real and raw. He laid it all out on the table. Is that atypical for the genre? Was he special in that space?
No, he wasn't. I mean, you know, you look at people like Chance the Rapper and Frank Ocean. No, I mean, there were a lot of people who were doing that kind of thing. But he did it in his own way, with his issues. You know, they weren't very, he didn't speak of these things generically,
mm-hmm.
You know. he spoke of them very specifically. And that was important because he was having these struggles. You know, a few months before he died, he was arrested for a hit and run. I mean, and he talked about that. You know, he didn't try to sugarcoat it. He didn't try to make humor out of it. You know, he understood, you know, I have everything right now and I could lose it. And there's a line like the last song, his last album, he has this line where he says, you could have the world in the palm of your hand and you still might drop it.
Yeah.
You know, and in a lot of ways, when I listened to Mac Miller, it was almost like reading someone's diary. It almost felt uncomfortable to listen to him because it was so raw. But that's what made, I think, his music so vital for a lot of people.
Now, I want to stay on the theme of loss for a minute, but also a celebration of a life. Because in a year where women were strong, we lost one of the greats, Aretha Franklin. She died in August at the age of 76 at pancreatic cancer. Her music, her voice, her impact on pop culture, it's really incomparable. And I want to just take a minute to run down some of her accomplishments because she had 18 Grammys. She was the first woman to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1987. And she was the youngest recipient of a Kennedy Center's honors in 1994. So I think we really should hear from her. This is her performance at the Kennedy Center in 2015 with her rendition of You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman. Now, not many people in any business are relevant for 50 years, let alone an artist with that kind of staying power. Why was she so special?
Because she was the queen of soul. Because she was unchallenged. Because, you know, there was never this idea that somehow, oh, you know, Aretha changed her music for the masses. No. She did what she did, and the masses came to her. Church never left her music. And that connection was so deep for her, I think it connected to fans as well. The depth of her soul, the depth of the passion in the way she sang, I think is, you know, that's what sustains a career for 50 years. And she was also just, for someone people didn't really seem to know particularly well, Aretha was, she was a cultural icon. You know, the outfits, the coats, the politics, you know, the way her songs became anthems for women and for people of color. You know, there aren't many artists who can do that and can do it for that many decades and stay relevant. You know, the clip you played from the Kennedy Center Honors, that's 2015. You know, she's already in her 70s at that point, and she brought the house down.
Including the woman who wrote the song, Carole King, right?
Who looked like she was hearing the song for the first time. You know, that's what Aretha Franklin can do, and that's why her passing was really, you know, certain deaths stop time. That was one of them.
Yeah. We've got just a couple minutes left, and I want to go through a few other big music moments of the past year, and I want to start with Childish Gambino, also known as Donald Glover. He is Renaissance man. He's a movie star. He's a singer. He's a rapper. He's an actor. He created the FX television show Atlanta, which has been a huge hit. He didn't have an album out this year, but right as the second season of Atlanta wrapped up, he put out this new song called This Is America. Let's listen to it for just a sec. Now, it wasn't just the song here that was huge this year. He had a music video. It rocked my world when I saw it for the first time, and it garnered nearly 40 million views in just the first 3 days. It had lots of allusions to American history and pop culture, and it also replicated some famous instances of anti-black violence and Jim Crow imagery. Some loved it, some hate it. Where do you fall on this one?
I loved it.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, I was almost shocked by it. I kept watching it and over again because it's one of those things that you see something different every time you watch because visually there's so much coming at you. And it's right. It was anti-black violence. It was police violence. It was Jim Crow. It was minstrel shows. The poses he was. I mean, it made people really stop and think. People analyzed that video like it was the Bible. Everybody had a take on what it meant and what he was saying. And, you know, know, that's what great art's supposed to do. It's supposed to provoke. It's supposed to put you in a different place and make you see the world a little differently. And I think that's exactly what Donald Glover did with This Is America.
You know, you referred to it as great art. And one more quick question on that. Was it necessary for it to be the song and the video, for it to be all of the art, all of the story, all of the message that he was trying to produce?
You know, I think you can do, it was sort of a multimedia presentation. You know, I think the video was very important. I don't know that you get it in the same way just by listening to the song.
Yeah.
You know, so I think, you know, as a political statement, you know, in such a strange year, it was perfect.
All right. In a sentence, what's the one thing you're looking forward to about music in 2019, Renee?
You know, I have to admit, I'm ready for some good rock music.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. You know, I feel like rock music has completely fallen off. You know, there's been great hip hop, there's been great R&B, but, you know, not a lot to be said for rock music. When you think about the great moments of music this past year, it's, you know, it's Drake, it's that kind of thing. It's not a rock band. So let's see what rock can do in 19.
So we're going to end on what the producers here would say is some not good rock music by Weezer. This is Renee Graham, columnist from the Boston Globe. Renee, thanks so much for being with us here today on Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Hey, that's our show for today. Thanks for joining Radio Boston. It's a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.